saving money on everything you need at Menards. Your roof is the first line of defense against the elements, and it enhances the appearance of your home's exterior. Owens Corning shingles offer ultimate protection and impressive curb appeal. Choose from 26 colors of Owens Corning Duration shingles and transform your home today. Shop our selection of roofing products on Menards.com. Plus, check out our weekly flyer and find plenty of great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable ad-free tales of terror. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show.
Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Listener discretion is advised. Hello there, listeners, and welcome back to Horror Hill. I'm your host and narrator, Eric Peabody, and tonight's episode is a bit of a special event. Not only are we featuring three, that's right, friends, three stories tonight, but they're all written by somebody that I know personally. Author C.C. Lucky is someone that I saw frequently back in my days playing thrash metal video game covers in the Bay Area, and while I suspect that raises its own questions, today we're here for C.C. Or rather, she's here for us. I've been chatting with her about featuring some of her stories for a while, and now, with the recent re-release of her short story collection, Lead Lights, the stars have finally aligned. The three stories we're covering tonight, The Visitor, Jackson and the Bee, and Caretaker, are all from that collection. With each of these tales being quick and deadly, I'm going to skip the usual synopses. Let's crack open Lead Lights, shall we? You're listening to the standard edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, and we can scale back some of our less savory means of generating money for the show. By the way, you wouldn't happen to still have all of your organs, would you? And now, from author C.C. Lucky, I give you The Visitor. 1. Leah sat up in bed and screamed into the crook of her elbow. It was that same dream again. The one where she was standing in a yard filled with dead grass and broken, sun-bleached toys. Beyond the yard was a house, a dilapidated wreck from the mid-20th century, dull brown with tan trim and windows which were thin and wavy with age. Bunches of tall weeds framed the cement stoop, which led up to a bent screen door hanging by a single hinge. She wanted to turn away from the house and run, But in the dream, her feet would not obey. Her shoes were held fast to the ground as though magnetized. Her hands were also rebelling. She watched her right hand pull a string from her pants pocket, and her left hand met with it behind her head, tying her hair into a ponytail. "That's better," she heard herself say. "Now I can see your face." Tears welled in Leah's eyes. "Stop," she whispered. "Walk," her mouth said. She moved forward with plodding, sluggish strides, as if wading through water. There was a quick movement in the window, a glimpse of someone peeking around a cobweb-festooned curtain before dropping back into shadow. As Leah arrived at the first step, the clump of weeds on her left trembled. A breeze, perhaps, had rattled the leaves. But no. Embedded in the leaves was a man's face. The weeds had grown and twisted around each other, creating the shape of a nose, eyes, and mouth. It was Connor. But her dream told her it wasn't really him. It was a trick. Leah suddenly became lucid, and the shock almost threw her out of the nightmare. The house flickered, and the edges of the yard shimmered and blurred. Yet, as hard as she tried, she could not quite swim up to the surface of the dream. The weeds spoke. "If you go in, you'll never come out." Leah felt a wave of dread crash into her. Fear rushed through her veins and chilled her stomach. Goosebumps broke out on her trembling arms. "I don't want to go in. I'm trying not to," she said to the weeds. "Try harder." The face disappeared, and then there were only leaves. Leah's left foot rose and climbed the first step. "No!" she yelled. But it was a dream, and no sound came from her mouth except a harsh whisper. "Please, no," she sobbed as her right foot raised and she moved closer to the door. She kept her head down and resisted looking up at the house, but she could not avoid the smell. There was mold and rat droppings and mossy mud, wet smells. And under all of that, a sour, sweet odor, like the dead mouse she had found in the attic when she was a little girl. The smell of rotting flesh. Her left foot rose again. She couldn't fight it. She was close enough now to reach out and touch the door. "Welcome home," she heard herself say. And she woke up. 2. "You look exhausted, babe." Connor examined Leah's face with gentle concern from across the table. "Did you sleep at all?"
"I had that dream again, with the house."
Leah could barely keep her eyes open. Their favorite sofa in the coffee shop was occupied, so they sat at the table in the corner by the windows. She watched the people walk by with their dogs. They all looked so happy and rested. A jogger sped past, wearing a red shirt so bright it made her migraine ring in her ears.
"It kind of feels like I never even woke up. The whole day's been a blur."
She pinched the bridge of her nose.
"I have a crazy headache, too."
"Maybe you should have ordered a decaf. You need to sleep tonight. Don't you have a philosophy exam tomorrow?"
"Yeah, but I have to work tonight, and then I have to study after that."
"Who needs sleep?" Leah smiled as her headache popped and crackled.
"I'll live."
"I hope so."
"I'm okay."
"I guess." "Oh, hey, look! A Frenchie!"
"Aww."
Leah melted. Just outside the window, a French bulldog waddled past, sporting a giant blue bow in its collar. It had walked through a puddle and was leaving a wobbly trail of wet paw prints behind.
"I want one so bad. But I can barely take care of myself," she sighed.
"Someday, maybe after we move in together. We'll get a big apartment and a whole herd of bulldogs." Connor peeked at her over the top of his tea.
"I already told you, I haven't decided about us moving in together. Anyway, I'm stuck in a lease in my studio. You know that."
"How convenient," Connor muttered.
I'm just not ready yet. We talked about this. I haven't lived with anyone since Jeffrey, and I'm not ready to share my space yet. You know what he did to me. She was so tired of repeating this conversation, this dance around the painful truths she had entrusted him with, knowing she couldn't really make him understand how her pain still affected her. Connor frowned. I'm not like him. Do you really think I am? Do I have to say the words out loud? Fine. I promise I'm not going to blow my brains out in your house and leave you to clean up the mess. I'm not Jeffrey. Give me a chance. Leo was stunned to silence, then moved to anger. To you, that's just a story I told you. It's not real to you. I had to live it. I still check for blood on the floor every time I walk through my front door. The fact that you can just say all those words out loud without feeling anything tells me you aren't really empathetic to my pain. Connor closed his eyes. Can we not fight? Who's fighting? You brought it up. I don't want to fight. I'm too tired. He bowed his head. I don't know. I'm sorry. I have to go. I'll text you tonight, okay? She picked up her bag. Don't leave mad, please. I'm not mad, I promise. But just give me a little more time. She bent over and kissed the top of his head. He sighed. Drive carefully, okay? Listen to music to help you stay awake. Driving tired is the same as driving drunk. Quit nagging. I'll be fine. If you say so. See you later. 3. Leah jolted awake. Her nightshirt was bunched up under her armpits, and her feet were numb with cold. Her forehead was coated in a clammy film of sweat. The blanket had migrated to the far side of the bed and was hanging off, touching the floor. She had been dreaming. It was a nightmare, but not the one about the house. There had been a professor shouting at her in class because she didn't turn in her homework. Something about a bulldog eating it. A stupid stress dream. Leah hauled her blanket back on top of the bed and pulled it over her shivering body. The warmth immediately began to lull her back to sleep. She concentrated on the clock ticking in the kitchen, as she often did at bedtime to clear her mind. She counted to 16 before she closed her eyes and was in the yard. The house stood in front of her. The odor was stronger now. She didn't even have to step close to smell it. The miasma drifted down the steps into the lot. The weeds by the stoop had wilted and were dying. Wispy clouds chased each other across a sickly purple sky. They were moving too fast overhead, like an old VHS tape stuck on fast forward. The curtain moved, as it always did, but this time a figure was discernible through the dust-caked pane. It was a thin man, hunched and scrawny, with skin hanging from his arms and hair, which was wild and sparse. His eyes were not kindly, but steely and cold and hungry. They wanted to devour her life, her youth. Her left foot took a step forward. No! She screamed, more frightened this time than ever before. The dream was more solid now, not just creepy, but threatening. Stalking her. Hunting her. She had never thought anything could be as horrifying as the house itself, but its tenant made her knees shake with terror and her bladder weak. Leah's right foot took a step. She thought perhaps she could collapse into the dirt to stop her forward progress. Her body wobbled, painfully wrenching her back, as she desperately tried to sit down hard like a stubborn toddler. But an unwelcome strength rose up within her, keeping her torso erect. Her left foot took another step. No! She screamed again, helpless. Leah's own voice betrayed her in tandem with her fourth step forward. Welcome to my home. As she spoke the words, she saw the man in the window simultaneously mouth them along with her. They were his words. He was using her mouth as his loudspeaker. She had almost reached the door. The stench was horrific. The man didn't dodge from view this time. She could see his filthy overalls and stained brown tank top, which had once been white. Scars and burns decorated his sagging skin. Leah grimaced and tried to look away from his staring eyes, but her head slowly wrenched back toward him, as if he held it in powerful, invisible hands. The man smiled, then opened his mouth wide, unhinging his jaws with serpentine hunger. Unable to look away, Leah's eyes found something at the back of his throat. He was forcing her to see. A tight cluster of slick black tentacles writhed like worms, each ridged with 100 serrated teeth. The man's face elongated absurdly as they pushed the mouth open with eager greed. If not for the window, he could have taken her entire head in his mouth, tentacles twisting and tangling with her hair. One tentacle, longer than the rest, whipped out and cracked the glass. Leah screamed and woke up. 4. Connor leaned over to the driver's side and wrapped his arms around her. Leah stopped shivering, just for a moment, while he held her. When he leaned back into his seat, her hands started shaking again.
"I'm sorry," she said. "It's so early. The sun isn't even up yet, and I'm at your door."
"It's okay. You know you're always welcome here. I'm worried about you, babe. Let me help."
"I don't know how you can. It's a dream. It can't be controlled."
Tears ran down Leah's cheeks.
"I'm so tired," she sobbed.
"I'll come over tonight. Just to, I don't know, to be there. I'll sleep next to you. Maybe that will help."
"Maybe. Okay, if you want."
Leah gazed at him with dark-ringed eyes, glassy and grateful.
"Thank you."
5. By the time the sun set at 8 o'clock, Leah could stay awake no longer. As she lay on her bed in her cozy apartment, the days of accumulated exhaustion felt overwhelming. Connor sat next to her, pressing his thumbs into the palm of her hand.
"I'll be right here watching over you, okay? I'm just gonna sit here and drink tea."
"Gross. Tea," she smirked, her eyes already closing.
I know, you hate tea. Just go to sleep. If you sleep, I'll make you some coffee when you wake up."
She burrowed under the covers, creating a cocoon, bringing the blanket up over her head, feeling the oxygen slowly deplete. It was dark, safe, and warm. When the air became too thin for comfort, she poked her head out and turned over. She took a long, slow breath and closed her eyes. Connor turned his attention to the kitchen. The cupboards were crammed with instant noodle cups, a jar of expired peanut butter, canisters of flavored coffee crystals, and stale crackers. Leah had never been a very good cook. He found a dusty but unopened box of Earl Grey tea bags in a remote corner of an upper cabinet and turned on the kettle. Leah seemed to be sleeping peacefully. She had whimpered once, but then turned over and fallen into a deep slumber. Sitting at the tiny dinette set in the kitchen, he watched her shoulder rise and fall with her breathing. He was sure he loved her, but he hadn't told her yet. She was so strong-willed, she made him feel weak, an ambitious law student who drank her coffee black. He preferred tea and was seeking a veterinary internship. She was fierce, self-assured. He was soft, nurturing. Were they compatible? The sex was good, and just spending time together was almost even better. It felt to him like a healthy relationship. But was it what she really wanted? Was he enough for her? The kettle squealed and he jumped. He had meant to turn it off before it made noise. He whipped his head around to check on Leah. She was still asleep. But something looked strange. The figure under the blankets was smaller, shrunken. Her head was barely visible on the pillow. He crept to the bed and bent over to check on her. As he neared her sleeping form, he gasped.
Leah's brown hair had turned gray.
What? Connor ejected. Leah, wake up!
He reached out and shook her shoulder. It was all wrong somehow. Bony, rigid, cold, corpse-like.
He touched her hair and recoiled as a clump came off in his hand. Her head twisted around and her hair fell away from her face. But it was not Leah. It was a thin, gray man with dry, sagging skin. His cruel eyes were vacuous, covered in thick white cataracts. He threw the blankets off the bed and fixed his gaze on Connor, then slowly crept toward him, crawling on all fours, his filthy overalls hanging off his gangly torso. Connor leapt backwards and slammed his hip into the kitchen counter, sending spikes of pain shooting down his leg.
"Where's Leah? Where's Leah?"
he screamed over and over. The man stood, wobbling slightly, and his head lolled. He seemed caught in an internal struggle, shaking his head back and forth. When the man looked up at Connor again, the eyes had turned brown and soft and began weeping. They were Leah's eyes.
"I went inside! I went inside!"
the figure screamed. The eyes turned white again, and the head jerked back with a malevolent grin. The man's cracked lips pulled back from empty, rotting gums. Black tendrils crept from the corners of his mouth, sending dark ichor dribbling down his chin. The front door crashed in its frame. Connor stared at it wildly and felt his mind begin to break. The sturdy apartment door had turned into a decrepit screen hanging by a single hinge. The paint on the previously white walls near the entryway had become grimy floral wallpaper, which was spreading across the room like a fast-growing fungus. Out of the corners of his eyes, he could see normal-looking areas of the apartment, but whenever he fixed his vision on the clean sections, they turned to blight. The encroaching decay invaded and corrupted wherever he looked. He felt his eyes were painting ruin onto the walls like brushes. Just on the edge of his awareness was the apartment as it used to be, a beautiful dream.
"Welcome to my home," the man said.
"No!" Connor shouted. "Let her go!"
He picked up the kettle, which had transformed into ugly flowered porcelain instead of the stainless steel pot he had set to boil just minutes ago.
"Leave her now!"
He swung the pot at the thin man's head. It struck true and made a sound like a dropped egg. The man collapsed onto the floor, exhaling gaseous breath from the deepest part of his lungs with a wet burping sound. The figure writhed for a few moments, then lay still.
"Where's Leah?" Connor yelled. "Where's Leah, asshole?"
He kicked the corpse. The figure inhaled sharply, and Leah's eyes opened. The dirty overalls turned into her nightshirt, and the gray flesh faded away like a passing vision.
"Connor, I can't see you. Where are you?"
He knelt over her and kissed her lips, hard enough to hurt his teeth. She gazed up into his sad blue eyes.
"I love you. I love you so much."
He started, but then froze.
"Connor? Connor?"
Leo watched with dread as his eyes turned white.
"Welcome to my home," he said.
"No!"
Leah yelled.
"You can't take him!"
She rolled out from under him and crawled toward the bed as he began to transform. First, the gray hair appeared, then the papery skin and the tattered clothing. In the final moments before the change was complete, the figure gasped out two pleading words.
"Kill me!"
Then the thin man took over.
"Welcome, welcome," it hissed.
6. When Leah was 6 years old, her dad let her go into a public bathroom alone for the first time. They had been at the mall to do some Christmas shopping. She felt very grown up and even paused by the mirror to pretend to fix her imaginary lipstick with a dainty flourish of her pinky finger. A woman came out of a stall and washed her hands in the sink, then left. As Leah sat on the toilet, she looked at the written messages scrawled on the cubicle walls. One said, "Fuck you, Sarah." Another pronounced, "Anarchy." There were several carved initials and a cross. She reached for toilet paper, and her heart sank into her stomach. There wasn't any left on the roll, not a single scrap. If she left the bathroom with a wet bum, Dad would never let her go alone again, not until she was in high school. "Hello?" she tried. "Anyone there? I'm out of toilet paper." There was a shuffle from the stall on her right. A hand appeared under the separating wall, gripping a wad of clean toilet paper. "Oh my gosh, thank you," she said in a passionate rush. She flushed and went to wash her hands. As she finished, the person who had helped her exited their stall. Leah caught his reflection in the mirror and froze. The man stood in the doorway of the open stall with his long arms dangling at his sides. His fly was open, and he was smiling, baring brown and broken teeth. Leah had just enough time to yell, "Dad!" before the man lunged toward her. He grabbed her hair, her shirt, groped at her. He tried to grab her arm, but it was slick with her tears, and he couldn't grip it. She hadn't even noticed she was crying. Leah worked her left leg free and brought it up hard. Her aim was true, and the man wilted quickly, dropping to his knees on the tile. She screamed again, "Dad!" Her father burst into the bathroom, wild-eyed, already furious before he even knew what was happening. As soon as he saw the tattered man on the floor, he grabbed Leah under his arm with the strength only a frightened parent can muster and charged from the bathroom. He called the police, who took away the bad man in handcuffs. While her father answered the policeman's questions, he held her on his lap, squeezing so tight she squeaked in protest. That evening, she and her father had a talk she never forgot. "You were very brave, Leah. You did just the right thing. I want you to know that none of what happened today was your fault. You handled it just right." He wrapped an arm around her shoulders. "If your mother was still with us, she'd be proud too."
"I know. Thanks, Dad."
"Do you understand exactly what you did that was so special?" She was confused.
I guess I'm not sure. I kicked him in the crotch like you told me I should do if that happened."
"It's more than that, Leah. You didn't panic. You looked for his weakness, and then you acted on it. You didn't freeze or give up. That kind of strength is rare, especially in a girl your age."
"I'm so sorry about what happened today, but I'm so proud of you. Remember that everyone has a weakness, and when someone attacks you, don't lash out blindly. Be strong, stay calm, breathe deep, and hit him where it hurts."
7. Where it hurts. That, at least, was something Leah understood well. She was an expert on pain. She was rarely free of it herself and easily recognized it in others. She crawled around to the other side of the bed, putting it between herself and the demon.
"Why me? Why Connor? What do you want?"
She observed the spots of grime on the overalls and the dimming light. The demon smiled.
"I want to welcome you to my home, Leah. Connor is in here with me. He isn't very happy right now. Why don't you come join us? I'm sure that would help."
"Tell me why."
She noted its thin arms and its sagging skin.
"It's simple. I'm hungry, and you are easy prey."
The demon crouched, stalking her. Leah locked its eyes in her measured gaze and knew that it was nearly blind behind its thick white cataracts.
"And honestly, I enjoy the hunt," it hissed. "Aren't you having fun?"
"I don't believe in demons."
"Well, that's silly, isn't it, Leah? I'm right here."
The demon smiled, and Leah could see a tiny black tentacle wriggling between its lips.
Anyway, who says I'm a demon?
She kept the wall to her back and placed her palms flat against the torn wallpaper. She lifted her heel and planted it on the wall, leaning into it, ready to fight.
What are you?
Bad luck, it said. Nothing more, but you can call me a demon if you like.
The demon opened its mouth. Its jaw hinged wide, and the top of its head fell back. Black tendrils rose from deep in its throat, their tiny teeth snicking and clicking against each other as they emerged and stretched out toward their prey.
I will eat you whole,
the demon said through Leah's mouth. She stayed calm. She did not panic. Its tricks no longer frightened her. Fear had been a luxury, and its time had passed. She lunged toward the demon and seized the tentacles in her fist, squeezing tight. It screamed with shock, and she heard the sound not only in her ears, but in her chest and her brain. His screams rang out from his body and her own in tandem, the loudest sound she had ever heard. She yanked.
I don't know where you came from, and I don't care!
A huge grip of tendrils tore loose like a hair clog from a drain. Black liquid streamed down her forearm, drenching her. The demon slapped at her with flabby, ancient arms and crumpled to the floor in a pool of dark ichor. As it collapsed into itself, her apartment became abruptly clean, the walls white once more. The door was made of sturdy wood, and the kettle was stainless steel again. All that remained was the demon and its growing puddle of nebulous blood. Leah leaned down to the demon's ear.
Now give him back. Give me Connor.
No,
he's mine,
the demon said. She jammed her fist into its throat and pulled out the rest of the tendrils. The demon withered further.
I can't,
it screamed from within her head, her mouth echoing each word.
I can't give him back. Get out of my house, bitch!
Oh, now you want me to leave. I thought I was welcome.
She plunged both hands into its mouth, one on its upper jaw and one gripping its lower. Pulling with all her strength, she snapped the demon's skull from its neck. She stood over its body, holding its jawbone in her left hand and its skull in her right. Its voice, now faint in her mouth, asked,
Why are you so strong?
Because I am hurt, and only the deeply wounded can be very strong. You are nothing! Get out of my house!
The demon's body desiccated before her eyes, its black tendrils wisping away into smoke. All that remained in the end was a large black smudge on the floor. It was done. But Connor was gone too. She sat on the bed, sobbing, until exhaustion once again took hold and she fell asleep. 8. Leah opened her eyes. She was having the dream again. She stood in bare feet on a little walkway made of sandy stepping stones, each a different color, olive green, brick red, sunshine yellow. They led to a stoop surrounded by bunches of spring flowers, bright as a watercolor painting. A sweet cottage rose before her, with soft curtains floating in open windows. The air smelled of lavender and seawater and carried the sound of distant waves crashing on a sparkling white beach. A wooden sign attached to the wall next to the door was carved with a pattern of seashells and one word, Welcome. In the window, there was a sudden movement. The curtain pulled back, and a man stepped up to the glass. Leah's heart pounded in her chest. But it was only Connor, smiling in the gentle way he always did when she was near. I love you, he mouthed.
I love you too.
She took a step toward the house. You've been listening to The Visitor by C.C. Lucky. Continuing on, this is Jackson and the Bee. 1. The wooden cabinet Jackson was curled up inside was barely large enough to fit him, and he had to sit on his foot, which was falling asleep. But it had been the safest spot in the trailer for the last 4 days, ever since the drone had arrived. It still hovered over the trailer. He could hear it. His initial hope that the battery would die had faded. It must be solar, charging enough during the day to last all night. And his camp was deep in the high desert. There was little chance of cloudy weather. Jackson slowly unfolded his aching body in the confined space. He opened the cabinet door a few inches to stretch out his leg, and his knee popped. The side of his foot stung where a bullet had zinged it 2 days ago. He had made a mad dash outside toward the propane tanks, but the drone was quicker, and it fired at him before he got 10 feet out the door. He was running out of food. He had enough water in the trailer's reserve tank, but he had eaten everything in the fridge first so as to use up the perishables, and it was now down to whatever crackers and snacks were in the pantry. The drone could see in through the windows, had shot out most of them already, and the only time it was safe to move around was when the winds picked up. The drone rarely left its position 20 feet above the trailer, but it had a hard time compensating for the desert wind, especially the strong gusts which rushed down the foothills and over the desert hardpan just as the sun started to set. It tended to drift, and if Jackson was careful, he could stay out of its line of sight for a few seconds at a time. As for a long-term plan, he had none. He never had unexpected visitors. Just a tax collector once, but Jackson didn't bother trying to make the court date he had delivered, and the man never came back. Even the federal government couldn't squeeze water from a stone. Jackson's sister had come out one time in the week after their father died. They had a fight, and she didn't return. He understood why and didn't invite her again. So, outside help was unlikely. He was on his own. The drone was really something else. It had first shown up just as he was taking his daily sabbatical in the outhouse. As he finished and opened the door, holding a magazine in one hand and yanking up his trousers with the other, it had taken its first shot at him, blew his hat off, and blasted the shit out of his outhouse. Jackson knew very little about drones, but this one looked army. It was that shade of olive green. What it wanted of him, he couldn't fathom. He wasn't a veteran. He'd never been important in any way. Just a drifter all his life, until he got tired of that and settled in the desert with his trailer and his dog. Then the dog died, and it was just him. Jackson's stomach gurgled. The buzzing overhead grew louder as the drone descended to investigate the sound. Jackson withdrew his leg into the cabinet, a movement his aching back vehemently protested. He closed the door most of the way, keeping it open just enough to spy on the hovering robot, with its camera lens like a wet black eye peeking through the window. The drone was clever, but its AI was not quite sophisticated enough to imagine where Jackson might be, and it had not yet discovered his cabinet hidey hole. So there it waited, with mechanical patience. Jackson didn't know how much longer he could outsmart it, but his time was running out. The drone drifted away to investigate the other side of the trailer. Jackson stretched his leg again and gauged the distance to the food pantry. He could probably make the trip if he was quiet enough, but he didn't feel like bothering with it. He was doomed, and he knew it. The drone would kill him. It was just a matter of time, and he'd never even find out why. Strange way for an old hippie to die. He thought over the various escape plans he had developed over the last couple days, but as always, they all seemed very unlikely to work. The drone's power source, the sun, was infinite. Its ammunition was not, but it learned quickly. Any attempt to make it waste bullets was dangerous and even appeared to make it smarter. Early in the siege, Jackson had tried to use his own reflection in the bathroom mirror as a decoy, But after the drone shot the glass out, it realized it had not killed its true target and backed off. It was that damn clever. The buzzing sound moved from the side to the back of the trailer. This was the safest spot. It was the time to set aside self-pity and take the opportunity while he had it. Jackson moved swiftly, grabbing a box of Ritz crackers from the pantry before slipping back into his cave. He munched slowly and carefully, limiting himself to 10, even though his hungry belly tried to coerce him into devouring the entire package.
"All right, old man. You really are running out of time," he whispered to himself, gently setting aside the cracker box. "For real now. It's gotta happen today, whatever it is. Do or die."
He shut his eyes and tried to visualize the various odds and ends strewn about the trailer. It was mostly junk. Stacked newspapers, coffee cans he'd used as ashtrays, a vintage record player, a replacement solar panel for his system in case the old one went out. In the bottom storage compartments under the floor were a tangle of Christmas lights, a plastic cooler, a toolbox, a few dog toys, and an RC car he had picked up at a yard sale during a grocery run last summer. The RC car. Now, that was something. Was the drone smart enough to ignore such an obvious temptation? Perhaps it would find the moving target irresistible after days of failing to catch its true quarry. The storage compartments were designed to be opened from outside the trailer, but that would be impossible. From what Jackson could remember, the RC car was stashed in the compartment directly below the cabinet in which Jackson hid. He would have to go in the hard way. The drone had appeared near the window with a view of Jackson's cabinet. He would have to wait, for now. But he had a plan. Or, at least, the beginning of one. 2. Some time later, Jackson awoke. He had fallen asleep, waiting for the drone to move. He cursed himself. How much time had he wasted? The narrow beam of light shining through the crack in the cabinet door was red-orange now. Must be late afternoon or early evening. He listened carefully. The drone was at the back of the trailer again, making its rounds. Perfect. He crept from the cabinet and collected the first few items he could lay hands on. A butter knife, an old hiking boot, a book of matches from Pete's Bar and Grill, and a handful of newspaper. An odd collection of items, but he wasn't sure exactly what he would need, and it was all he had time to grab before he heard the drone begin to change position. On his way back to the cabinet, he cast a longing glance at the food pantry, but he was out of time. The box of Ritz crackers would have to do. Safely back in his cabinet, he wedged the butter knife into the corner joint between the floor and the wall. There wasn't much give. Back and forth he wrenched the knife, creating a long gash at the bottom of the crumbling particle board wall. But the floor was made of real plywood and much thicker. He worked loose some splinters from the joined edge, then dug hard, pausing every few minutes to pick out thin shards of sharp wood. Eventually, he succeeded in breaking through into the compartment below. He had made a tiny hole about the size of a dime in an hour of work. His arthritic hand throbbed with pain. He ate 10 crackers using his left hand, letting his right hand rest. If only he had a saw. There was almost definitely one outside, near the little wood pile by the fire pit. He had used it to cut up old discarded furniture to burn during the winter months. Junk like that was always easier to find than real firewood, usually free, too. It was amazing what people threw out. For now, though, the saw might as well be on the moon. He'd have to make do with the butter knife. Jackson removed a thick shoelace from the hiking boot he had grabbed and wound it tightly around the handle of the knife, making it easier to grip in his sore hand. As he reinserted the knife in the hole, he heard a sharp bang in the distance. A lightning bolt. Thunder could mean rain, which meant clouds. He silently prayed to God, whom he had much neglected throughout his life, for enough cloud cover to disrupt the drone's charging cycle. But Jackson never stopped digging, carving, chipping away at the plywood. He had placed his life in God's hands before and knew a bait and switch when he saw one. He kept working through the night. 3. By midnight, Jackson had a hole big enough to jam his aching hand through. Now his shoulder hurt too. He'd had to pee in the hunting boot before lobbing it out of the cabinet doors like a soppy grenade. He managed to fling it through the busted kitchen window. A perfect shot. It landed in the dust and was promptly blasted by the drone. One more bullet wasted. Good. He reached down into the compartment and rummaged around, gritting his teeth in fear of a rat bite or, Lord forbid, a spider bite. His fingertips brushed the bundle of Christmas lights, a rusted Christmas tree stand, and the corner of a cardboard box which might hold the RC car. Withdrawing his arm, he noticed a small oozing cut at his wrist. He tore off a scrap of newspaper and stuck it to the blood like he would with a shaving nick, and got back to work. 4. By dawn, the hole was big enough for the RC car, but not the box it was stored in. It would have to do. Jackson's arm, shoulder, and back screamed with pain and had started in with long, wrenching cramps. When his back spasmed, it was all he could do to keep himself from kicking open the cabinet doors just for a moment to relieve the pressure and stretch his muscles. But he could hear the relentless buzz of the drone outside, a cheerful worker bee sound. The lightning storm had passed in the night to make way for an extravagantly sunny and beautiful morning. Jackson moaned as a small cramp ricocheted down his torso, right into the curve of his waist where he was ticklish. Nothing ticklish about that cramp, though. It made his torso twist until he felt a foreboding twinge in his spine. He waited for it to pass, clenching his jaw. Breathing slowly and steadily, he gripped the knife in his left hand, his clumsy side, and lowered it into the hole. His right hand was too worn out now for an operation this delicate. With slow deliberation, he slid the knife under an end flap of the RC car's box. He twisted the knife, tearing the lid, but it gave only a tiny bit before sliding off the blade and landing an inch away, nearly out of reach. Jackson gasped in shock and froze, resetting his actions. He closed his eyes and tried to create a mental image of the box from the scant information his hands and knife had discovered. He had not laid eyes on the box for over a year, but he thought it was probably about 10 inches wide, 12 deep, and 4 or 5 tall. Small enough to have wiggle room in the storage compartment, the lid was hinged like a donut box. Jackson again wedged the knife under what he hoped was the top flap and lifted gently, letting the box rest on the flat of the blade. Then he held his breath and pulled, using the weight of the box to drag it closer to the hole. When it was close enough, he pressed his thumb onto the lid, pinching it between his fingernail and the blade, and slid the box the rest of the way until it was directly beneath the opening. The light was dim, but he could see the bright red box with its drawing of a maniacally excited kid holding a remote control and the clear cellophane window that showed the car inside. The drone fired. Jackson uttered a short old man yelp and dropped the knife. He hit his head on the top of the cabinet and saw stars.
"What the?"
he yelled before he could clap his hand over his mouth. What on earth had the drone fired at? From the outside of the trailer, near the wall behind Jackson's cabinet, he heard a pitiful squawk. It sounded like a bird dying in pain. The drone had bagged itself a desert crow, probably one of the fat hens that sometimes perched on top of the trailer and screeched in the early morning hours. One more bullet wasted, but Jackson had dropped his knife. It had clattered away into some unknown corner of the compartment, out of reach. Jackson gripped the cardboard box between his first and second fingers and pulled it as close to the opening as he could, but the bottom compartment was not tall enough to swing the lid open. His bleeding forearm, itching at 100 tiny lacerations from rubbing on the splintered plywood, caught on the jagged opening in the floor. If he wanted to make the hole wider, he would need to find another tool. Jackson opened the cabinet door, peeked at the kitchen window, and pulled back just in time before a bullet zinged past his head and cracked into the wood. The drone knew where he was, had probably heard his stupid yell. He had been discovered. Jackson slammed the cabinet shut and plunged his arm into the hole. He scraped his nails at the box, shredding and ripping, while the skin on his arm tore and dripped blood down his wrist. He finally worked the little car free of its styrofoam casing and pulled it up. He reached back in and gripped the tiny knob at the end of the remote control antenna and pulled it up too, retrieving the control box once the antenna finally stopped extending. He had it. One question remained, and it was a big one. Had he forgotten to remove the batteries? It sure sounded like something he'd do. He prayed again, this time to his absent-minded and probably a little drunk past self. Please let me have left the damn batteries. Another bullet plunked into the cabinet, missing his head by half a foot. The batteries were there. He nearly whooped for joy, but managed to calm down just in time. He had already given away too much information about his location. The drone had not left its position immediately outside the kitchen window, but it did not fire. Its ammunition must be running low. It waited for him. Jackson flipped a red switch on the controller, and the car emitted a tiny beep. The drone fired a single shot as if startled by the sound, but again missed Jackson by inches. What next? If he opened the cabinet door, he'd be shot. He cast about in the dim, tiny space. All he had left was the book of matches, the newspaper he had grabbed, and the box of writs, now empty. He had an idea. It was a dangerous idea, but it was the only one, so that didn't matter. Jackson crammed the writs box and the newspapers into the hole. He prayed one last time to God, to himself, and to whoever else was listening. Let the compartment vent be clear. Let the drone see the smoke. Let him not simply be roasted like a Thanksgiving turkey here in this cabinet. Let his final scheme work. Jackson lit the paper in the hole and planted both feet tightly over the top, trying to keep the smoke heading toward the vent in the side of the storage compartment. The drone continued to buzz outside the kitchen for another minute as the smoke came up through the hole under his feet and the plywood under Jackson's ass became hot. He grimaced as his skin began to singe. He bit his lip and tears streamed from his eyes. Smoke filled the cabinet, searing his throat, and he fought the urge to cough. Finally, the drone uttered a tiny bleep and whirred up above the trailer to examine the source of the smoke billowing from the rear side. He had only a few seconds to make his move. Jackson burst from the cabinet and opened the trailer door with quick, careful movements. He set the RC car on the hard desert floor where he would be able to view it from inside the trailer, then dashed back in, taking up position by the kitchen window. The drone was already returning, unable to make anything of the smoking vent. It spotted the RC car, but held its fire. It sidled close, extending a lens to get a closer view. Jackson flipped forward the acceleration lever on the remote, and the car jumped to life. The drone lurched straight up in the air, then fired a shot. Jackson made the tiny car serpentine along the playa, left to right, back and forth, slamming on the brakes, then leaping forward again. Once, it hit a large stone and flipped forward, but it righted itself and again sped towards its destination. The drone took the bait and began firing steadily, drilling bullet holes into the sand. When the RC car bumped into the propane tanks and was halted, the drone rained bullets on its target without reservation. One bullet ricocheted off the top of a tank with an Old West zing, before the next one neatly penetrated the metal. The tanks exploded. The RC car was obliterated, and the drone was blown from the air. It tumbled to the ground like a crumpled spider. The explosion walloped the side of the trailer with a wall of heat, scorching Jackson's skin and burning away his eyebrows. Smoke billowed from every window as the trailer swayed and rocked in the blast. All around him, items began to catch fire. The kitchen curtains, his papers, his cigarettes. Jackson leapt from the doorway and rolled onto the sand. He stumbled 50 feet from the fire before collapsing, bleeding and broken in the dirt, with his eyes fixed on his burning home as his consciousness faded. 5. Thudding in the distance. The rhythmic sound buzzed and whirred like the drone, but it was much deeper. The ground vibrated with the noise as it neared. Dust and grains of sand danced on the desert floor in time with the thumping blades. A military helicopter approached and hovered directly over the lonesome trailer, filling the night sky with a chest-sinking rumble. It was stationary for a few minutes before a searchlight beamed from a spot near the cockpit. A voice roared over the din of the engine. "You are in unlawful possession of a damaged United States Army drone. If you do not surrender the equipment immediately, this area will come under direct fire." Jackson groaned. His wrist was broken. His head throbbed. He blinked his eyes several times, but every star in the sky still appeared doubled, tripled. "Relinquish the equipment immediately. You have 1 minute remaining before this area is subjected to heavy fire." Everything was happening too fast. Jackson rose to his feet, sand pressed into his burnt skin, sticking to the blood. The helicopter's light was aimed not at him, but at his smoldering trailer. He waved, but his dark skin was invisible in the desert night. He staggered toward the light, falling hard on his knee, struggling to make contact with the soldiers in the helicopter while there was still time. He wanted to crawl. It would be so much easier than this painful lurching, but his shattered wrist wouldn't allow it. He gathered his feet under him and made a final, clumsy run into the searchlight. He gazed up at the helicopter, squinting, blind. "Final warning! Release the equipment immediately!" Jackson shouted, "I blasted it! I don't know where it is!" But his thin voice was carried away by the steady, roaring beat of the blades. The helicopter opened fire. A barrage of bullets pinged and panged off everything in the yard. The outhouse, the trailer, and Jackson. As his vision darkened, the last sound ringing in his ears was mindless, thoughtless gunfire. He tumbled to the ground. Just before his eyes closed, the spotlight shut off and the helicopter swung about to leave. In the moonlight, for just a moment, he had a clear view of it before it flew away towards the hills. Through the windscreen, he saw two seats reflecting the green glow of a navigation screen. Nothing else. The cockpit was empty. We've just concluded Jackson and the Bee. And now, dear listeners, to finish up our spotlight on author C.C. Lucky, I present Caretaker. 1. A soft breeze toyed with the leaves and young budding fruit of the lemon trees which lined the winding driveway. The morning sun was also a lemon, yellow and fresh in the sky. Sparrows flocked and danced in its rays, bickering over flies and gnats, swooping in the wide blue sky for the pure joy of it. The idyllic day couldn't be brighter, but not one of the birds lit upon the dark house at the end of the driveway. Whenever their playful carousing neared the wrought iron fence encircling the yard, they stopped short, banked to one side, and zoomed back down the drive to rejoin the throng. The house was a patchwork, a Frankensteinian monster pieced together from many different owners over the course of many decades. The front of the house was pallid gray, streaked with water stains. The roof was brown and sickly green, although that coloration may have been the result of last winter's moss dying off in the summer heat. The chunky front door was craftsman style, the frail balcony was Victorian, and there was one odd castle turret jutting clumsily from the east rear corner. The structure strained under the weight of its ugliness, emanating a feeling of loathing at its own perpetual, painful existence. There were no bird nests in the rafters, no mouse holes in the cellar walls, and no rats in the attic. The small creatures knew better. The house was furiously sentient. 2. Jazz had heard rumors about the house since she was in elementary school. It wasn't that she was scared of the place. She was, kind of. But no one had been out to the property in years, not since the last body had been recovered. And she needed juice. One good story to cap her first year of journalism studies. The supposedly haunted house was not really news. It was a time-worn chapter of the local folklore, but a follow-up piece after nearly a decade of abandonment might be interesting enough. It was worth a shot. The house loomed into view as she drove through the rows of lemon trees. Jazz balanced her phone on her steering wheel and snapped a few photographs of the approach. It was such a wonderfully stereotypical haunted house. Almost too obvious. Really, how could anyone be afraid of this place? It was a caricature. The door was locked, so she crept in through a broken window. It hadn't been vandalized. On the floor lay a tree branch, which must have crashed through the glass during the strong storms last November. The house was grimy, but tidy. She had been prepared for smashed furniture, graffiti, drug paraphernalia, signs of squatters, but there was none of that. It was as if the previous tenant had simply set down their teacup, picked up their bag, and walked out. Jazz scribbled notes on her tablet about what she could see in the dim light. A gaudy floral sofa, which was the centerpiece of the living room, thick dust on antique wooden furniture, a carved German cuckoo clock on the wall with hands frozen at 11:29. She wondered, AM or PM? Jazz opened the glass panel on the front of the clock and nudged the pendulum with her fingernail, bringing it to life. It began to tick-tock steadily, a comforting and homey sound. A tiny portrait was affixed to the bottom of the pendulum, a running horse with its upright tail flying in the wind, beautifully detailed. As she watched the picture sway, a momentary dizziness gently rocked her. Back, forth. What had she been doing? With some difficulty, she tore herself away from the clock. Averting her eyes was uncomfortable, like being jostled awake from a desperately needed nap. But she had work to do, and the sunlight was already beginning to wane. Jazz ascended the stairs. She was astonished at the fine condition of the building. The steps barely creaked. She could see why so many people over the years had sought to invest in the house and improve it, each contributing their own unique additions to the architecture. The place had good bones. In fact, if she'd had any money at all to put towards real estate... A dull, thudding sound interrupted her thoughts just as she reached the top step. It was the house settling, she decided, as it was unused to visitors these days. Well, perhaps she would visit more often from now on. Perhaps she could make some additions of her own. She could add a garden and a balcony and... She drifted down the hallway and paused to examine a series of portraits hanging on the wall. Some were men, suited and stuffy. Every other picture was a woman, proper and sad, each wearing a frock of blue or gray. The paintings were not very well done, but conveyed a certain somber mood. A sense of angry determination that the artist somehow elicited, despite the poorly executed splotches and splashes of paint which affronted the canvas. The final painting featured a stern madame who glared down at her as if she were an intruder. No matter. Jazz would soon make the house her home, and when she did, she could lock that picture away in the closet. She stuck her tongue out at the woman and moved on. Jazz passed a table cluttered with dusty knickknacks. She picked one up, a porcelain figure of a pale, cherubic boy holding a stalk of corn. At the base of the statue, 1972 was painted in looping gold script. On the bottom was a thrift store price tag, 15 cents. With a dreamy smile on her face, she gently set the boy down and turned toward a narrowing section of the hallway which led to a spiraling staircase. Was this the castle turret she had seen on her drive through the lemon trees? That seemed so long ago now. As she climbed, the passageway narrowed, each step smaller than the last. By the fifth step, she had to twist her body and crawl upward, clawing with her hands to gain every inch as the stairwell crushed in on her. The house was attempting to keep her out of the room above, but she wouldn't give in. As her body became wedged in the narrow passage, she began to groan softly with her effort, but she was unaware of the sound. She knew only that she must see the entire house, must explore every darkened corner. As she struggled and fought to progress, a large bird flapped down from the top of the turret. It was a scruffy chicken with tarry black feathers molting out of its pimpled skin. The bird pecked at her eyes and tangled its talons in her hair, screeching with its beak wide open. It beat her face with its wings until she stumbled backward, tumbling down the stairs. Her head hit the wooden floor with a tremendous crack, and as she fell unconscious, she wondered what the sound had been. 3. Hours later, beautiful birdsong roused her from sleep. She felt like a fairy princess called back into consciousness by an animal friend, awakening from a magical slumber in her great castle. But there was something strange about the birdsong. It was harsh, mechanical. A cuckoo clock. And she was not cradled in a princess bed, but lying on a hard wooden floor. She sat up quickly and her head flooded with pain. The hall was dim, as the only light was the moon, a bright silver dollar shining through a window near the turret stairs. Why had she come here? There was no story here. It was just a filthy old house. She felt as if the place had reached down and drawn her here and wished her to stay. Well, the spell was broken. The cuckoo clock had stopped chirping. How many times had it chimed? 10? 11? She made her way down the main staircase, massaging her throbbing head with her fingertips. When she looked up from the steps, she stopped short. There was a figure standing between Jazz and the front door. It was tall, nearly as tall as the ceiling. She blinked in the dim light until she could see details. Yet what she saw made no sense. The figure resembled the front half of a decaying horse. Its legs ended in hooves. The neck was broad and muscled, tipped by an elongated skull framed with ratted and filthy strings of coarse hair. Its head was bowed, but she could see a glint of red in its eyes. The reek of putrefying flesh was overwhelming, and it stung her nose. Segments of fat and muscle sloughed off the figure, dripping like melting wax to the floor. Its hooves were crusted with drying mud and decomposing matter. It swayed, rocking slowly back and forth, dumb and malevolent as a night terror. Then it whipped its head up and to the side, fixing her with a wide ruby eye. When it charged her, it stomped its massive hooves on the floor, trying to crush her under hundreds of pounds of rotten horse meat. Jazz dodged, and it shrieked with rage, a screaming whinny that was louder than any earthly creature could deliver. She crawled toward the window she had entered through, but the horse lurched forward. The next moment, it was upon her, crushing her with its entire weight, popping her ribs. Jazz dug and scraped at the cold, dead flesh, tearing out chunks of slimy meat. She inhaled to scream and got a mouthful of sour horse mane like 100 strands of stinking fish line from an old bait box. Unable to breathe or hear or run, pinned under the beast, she reached for its face. But the neck was too long,
She couldn't reach its eyes to put them out with her thumbs. In desperation, she plunged her hands into the gaping holes behind its shoulders where the rest of the horse's body should have been. Putrid liquid trickled down her arms from its open wounds. She dug deep, seeking whatever organ or magical fetish the creature possessed which allowed it to live on after death, but found nothing other than rancid matter and crumbling bone. Deeper and deeper she dug. In the final moments before she lost consciousness, the creature weakened and rolled off of her, smashing into the sofa and knocking over a floor lamp. Jazz breathed deeply, her head spinning with a sudden rush of air. The horse screamed again in frustration as it became entangled in the sofa cushions and the power cord from the lamp. As she pulled herself across the living room floor, she noticed a tiny door in front of her, a storage room under the stairs. She closed herself in and huddled, gasping in the dark as sharp pains racked her broken ribs. The living room went silent. The cuckoo clock made no more noise. The horse thing was still. 4. When Jazz felt able to move again, she pulled her phone from her back pocket and stared at the screen. Who should she call, and what should she say? The police would never believe her. She would have to invent a story about how her injuries had occurred. Perhaps she could do that. She was a writer, after all. At the far edge of the light cast by her screen, she saw a shadow move. In the darkness under the stairs, where the bottom step met the floor, there was a grunt and a shuffling sound. It was not a shadow, but a beast. She heard herself whimper, "No, please, no." But the thing began to shift back and forth, rocking its body, inching toward the glow of her phone. Jazz saw its snout first, slimy and slick. Then it wriggled its pale torso into the light, scraping at the floor with its hooves, and its black, beady eyes came into view. Little hairs stuck out all over its face and floppy ears. It smiled, baring thick, yellow teeth. The massive pig squealed. In its cry, she heard words.
"Our house! Our house! Get out! Get out!"
Jazz burst out through the small door, wildly scanning the living room for the horse, but it had vanished. The sofa was undisturbed, and the lamp that the horse had knocked over was upright, as if her battle with the creature had never happened. The pig crashed and grunted behind her, shrieking in anger as it attempted to raise its swollen gut from the floor and give chase. The front door was shut with a keyhole lock that was secured from the inside, impossible to open. She glanced toward the broken window, but in the light of the moon, she saw the faint silhouette of the horse. Jazz sprinted toward the rear of the house and found a kitchen, but it too was occupied. A black and white spotted cow wearing a chef's toque stood upright at the stove. It held a massive wooden spoon in its teeth, and it had its head twisted sideways to stir a gigantic, overfilled cook pot. It languidly turned its head to gaze at her, as pink drops ran from the spoon and splattered onto the floor. A human foot jutted from the sickening stew. Jazz could see nail polish on its toes. On the counter next to the stove lay a platter, and she caught sight of a bit of blonde hair. But Jazz could look no more. She wrenched at her rooted legs and pulled herself out of shock just as the lurching pig, still following close, thumped at her heels. As she ran past the cow and out the back door, she retched at the reek of boiling flesh. The backyard was a nightmare of braying sheep. They pressed against her, rubbing her with clumped wool, matted with black mold. A flock of geese with uplifted wings spread wide charged toward her, screaming in rage. Several rabbits joined the fray, their eyes reflecting red as they nipped at her toes. When she fled, the animals gave chase. They bit at her legs, causing her to fall and roll bodily through the dirt under the winking stars. As she regained her feet,
she saw she stood near a barn. Jazz slammed the door shut behind her, and the screams of the menagerie faded, carried away on a breeze as if they had never been. She slumped onto a pile of desiccated hay, sobbing into her hands. There was a tiny click at the door. Someone had locked her in. But she was alone, and that was all that mattered now. No animals in the barn, only Jazz. She trembled against a plank wall, her bloodshot eyes wide and staring, as her adrenalized muscles twitched with shock. 5. Beams of cold moonlight illuminated the barn floor in stripes. When her eyes had adjusted to the darkness, Jazz discovered she was not the first to make a nest in the corner where she hid. Someone had been there before her. There was a cup and a pencil and an old sock and a book. No, a diary. It was filled with scrawled notes and clumsily drawn pictures. A lemon tree, a pig, and a scribbled black blob which resembled the horse thing. The notes were nonsensical. They spoke mainly of love for the house and included a manifesto with plans for retaking the structure from some kind of invader. The mad scrawl was faint from water damage, but Jazz could pick out sentences which sounded like parts of a love letter. The writer believed the house loved him back, but before he could be united with his paramour, he must deal with the livestock. Those creatures which were so attached to the dwelling, they battled for it even in death, murdering any encroaching human in bestial rage. Jazz leafed through sheets of gibberish, pages filled with passionate words of love and hate, until the book ended abruptly. The last legible words were, "Bless this house," followed by endless paragraphs of chicken scratches. Several black feathers were stuck in among the last few pages. As she reached the end of the diary, she noticed that her fingertips felt cold and hard, as if frostbitten. She squinted at them in the scant light. They had darkened to dull gray. Her chin tingled, and when she brought her hand to her face, she was shocked to find coarse hairs growing from her cheeks. Her head throbbed as tiny goat horns burst through her skull, spilling trickles of blood to be caught by her eyebrows. Jazz screamed and kicked, but the transformation continued unabated. A tufted tail unfurled from her lower spine, and her front two teeth grew large and clumsy, forcing her canines to split apart and fall out. Her screaming turned to frantic braying as the pupils of her eyes ripped and stretched into hyphenated goat eyes. Thick black lines ringed in lemon-yellow irises. Her fingers and toes fused into tough keratin plates, then grew into hooves, which clattered on the barn floor as she struggled to stand on all fours. When her metamorphosis was complete, she stood panting, her breath bursting in gasps from her small lungs. She heard a click at the door as it was unlocked. The horse stood there, but it no longer frightened her. It was the caretaker, and she was a member of its flock. Now she could stay forever. You've just heard Caretaker by C.C. Lucky. C.C. Lucky lives in Rim of the World, a beautiful mountain community in Southern California, with her small family, including some very cute Pembroke Welsh Corgis. Her writing is influenced by her studies for her Bachelor of Arts degree in philosophy from California State University, Long Beach. Her favorite hobbies are hiking, collecting oddities, and playing live music. You can contact her and find the rest of her books at www.cclucky.com. That's CCLUCKEY.com. Well, folks, that about wraps things up for tonight. If you enjoyed hearing CC's work, let us know and we'll see about getting more of her stories on the show. In the meantime, I'd like to thank her for providing tonight's entertainment and humbly request that she order a truly delicious burrito to eat in my honor, for where I live, sadly, there are none. Thanks also go to you, dear listeners, and I hope that you'll join me again next week at the same day and time for more scary stories. Until then, friends, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted and narrated by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Original music provided by Eric Peabody and Nikki McSorley. Finalization by Eric Peabody and Craig Groshek. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at natalie@chillingtalesfordarknights.com to have your work considered for future production. Seeing as how we're all living in a technological nightmare of our own devising, I'll ask you to follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. Not only will you have appeased the dark gods of cyberspace, but you'll be kept in the loop as we prepare more terrifying content. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend becoming a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Otis Gyre's Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, Paul J. McSorley's Fear from the Heartland, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. As for me personally, I'm on most social media as Viking Guitar or Viking Guitar Productions. I'm always on the lookout for new stories to narrate and new music projects to mix or master. If that's of interest to you, feel free to reach out and we can talk turkey. Also, I will be back next week with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.